This is an update on the case of the unidentified decedent known as Julie Doe, found in Florida in 1988. In 2019, we released our first ever coverage of cold cases involving unidentified decedents, also known as Doe cases. Since then, we've made the unidentified a key focus of the Fall Line, as we feel that they are the least likely to get media attention. Their families aren't there to advocate for them. And without a narrative history in place, available research for coverage is scarce. Our first four cases were the homicides of a woman found murdered in Florida, known as Julie Doe, two small children who died in separate incidents in Georgia, known as Christmas Doe and Dennis Doe, and a woman known as the Jenkins County Jane Doe, a homicide victim discovered in South Georgia. We discussed all four cases during our fourth season, which we've been working to remaster to improve audio quality. We also want to provide updates for each case where we can. Our first release in that series was the case of Julie Doe, and our work on that case connected us with the Trans Doe Task Force's Lee and Anthony Redgrave, who'd been at work on Julie's case for some time in 2019. At that point, they were volunteering with the DNA Doe Project. They'd also formed the Trans Doe Task Force to specifically focus on the cases of trans and gender nonconforming and expansive unidentified decedents who are critically underserved in death investigations. We shared our research with their team, and Anthony Redgrave served as a special content advisor on Julie's 2019 episode, where he worked with us to specifically select language most appropriate to address both use in the scientific world of forensics and in the trans community. Longtime listeners will remember that Julie was originally identified as a cisgender woman. Later DNA testing revealed that she was presumed male at birth and had gone through gender-affirming surgeries later in life. An important additional note is that we only know the bare basics of Julie's DNA results. As Anthony Redgrave pointed out in a recent conversation, we can't know the specifics of Julie's chromosomal karyotyping, as those tests weren't run. Those are the kinds of tests that could have given us insight into nuanced possibilities. For instance, the test could indicate an intersex variation. Back in 2019, when discussing DNA results, we all chose the term biological male, as that's the use applied in forensic science. This was before anti-trans bigots chose to weaponize and purposely misconstrue concepts of science to directly attack the human and healthcare rights of trans and non-binary people across the globe. The biological profile is a term used in anthropology to refer to estimated sex, ancestry, stature, and age. In the following episode, you'll hear us use the term biological a few times in that context. In 2019, that was the reference we all chose, made before this spurious weaponization began. If Anthony had content advised now, in 2022, he notes that we would have shifted to another use form. Language changes and targeted efforts to weaponize words to oppress trans adults and youth are a pressing issue. But it's important to mention that even in anthropology and other disciplines, there are ongoing conversations about what biology means in terms of sex and ancestry. In February of 2022, Dr. Amy Michael, a frequent Fall Line contributor, and a number of other biological anthropologists and graduate students in the discipline hosted a symposium at the annual American Academy of Forensic Sciences conference. Anthony Redgrave was among the featured speakers. The topic of the symposium was Queered Science, Interdisciplinary Approaches to Gender-Inclusive Research. Graduate students and faculty presented on the effects of trans exclusion in forensics, discussed sex and gender variation in regard to human remains, language used in reporting and recording, and looked at solutions and inclusion from a variety of angles. You can still view highlights from that symposium, which we've included in our show notes. Since 2019, the Trans Doe Task Force has become a nonprofit with a dedicated first-of-its-kind database called LAMP. We covered the LAMP database, which stands for LGBT Plus Accountability for Missing and Murdered Persons, on a previous episode. There's a link in our show notes if you'd like to check it out. Any agency hoping to identify a trans or gender nonconforming or expansive decedent or looking for customized training can contact the Trans Doe Task Force via the links in our show notes as well. The Redgraves have also formed Redgrave Research Forensic Services, LLC, where they take all forensic genetic genealogy cases. Since their formation, Redgrave Research has made a number of identifications, including one of Canada's oldest and best-known cold cases, known as the Babes in the Woods murders. In 1953, the bodies of two young children were found in a Vancouver park. Police estimated they died in the late 1940s. In February of 2022, Redgrave Research successfully identified these children as David and Derek Bousquet. Julie Doe's case has remained with the DNA Doe Project, who gave us an update on the progress of her case. When we covered Julie's case in 2019, she did not have a viable DNA sample that could be used for forensic genetic genealogical research. There had been three separate extraction attempts prior to 2020, all of which had failed. Finally, though, a fourth attempt retrieved viable DNA. And after sequencing, the DNA Doe Project was able to upload Julie's kit to the public DNA site, GEDmatch, and begin to compare her to other people who've opted to share their DNA results. As a reminder, genetic genealogists can only compare kits against those on two sites, FamilyTree DNA and GEDmatch, where participants have purposely opted in to share their results. They do not have access to private sites like Ancestry or 23andMe. You have to choose to share that information with them by downloading your raw DNA file from those private sites and then uploading it to a public site. If you've uploaded your raw DNA, which you can obtain from your own private DNA results from Ancestry or 23andMe, but you haven't clicked the opt-in to law enforcement box on GEDmatch, your results cannot be used in cold cases. The cold cases in question are limited to unidentified persons and violent crimes. In terms of cold case work, sometimes genetic genealogists get lucky. They load a kit into the system, and 24 hours later, a workable match appears. And what does a workable or high match mean? For a genetic genealogist, anything above 20 centimorgans is a strong enough, barely, genetic relationship for them to begin slowly building a family tree. According to genome.gov, quote, a centimorgan, abbreviated as the letters CM, is a unit of measure for the frequency of genetic recombination. But strong enough doesn't mean strong. 20 is the absolute bare minimum, a very, very distant relationship. To put that in perspective, if Brooke and I matched at 20 or 30 centimorgans, she might be my sixth cousin or my sixth cousin once removed, or something even more distant, like an eighth cousin. There are a variety of possibilities, and a genetic genealogist might work for months or years trying to identify decedents who only have very low matches in the double digits. Forensic or investigative genetic genealogists, as some prefer to be called, hope for a match above 100 centimorgans. A case with a match in the 300s or 400 centimorgans can be solved often in a matter of hours, but often public sites like GEDmatch will have matches in the low 50s to low 100s. Our senior research assistant, Brian Waters, who is a genetic genealogist, also pointed out that even with a high match in the 300, 400, 500 range, adoption can complicate an investigation, especially if the decedent has been adopted into a family. High matches can pinpoint where an individual may descend from, but without documentation, it can hinder the chance of determining the person's identity and life. And genetic genealogists may face other issues, such as family trees that include high levels of endogamy. Endogamy occurs when a population includes high incidence of intermarriage. This can be common in geographic, cultural, religious, ethnic, or other communities. It's important to note that this is not synonymous with incest. This is more comparable with a number of residents in a small town being distantly related, such as a fifth or sixth or seventh cousin. This can, however, create issues for experts who are trying to separate the strands of family trees and make clean lines from one person to another in order to identify a Doe. In the case of Julie Doe, the DNA Doe Project was excited to upload her kit to GEDmatch, but was not lucky enough to have that initial high hit. They are still actively seeking more people to match, especially those who live in the southeastern United States or have family roots here. The DNA Doe Project has recently launched an initiative on social media and at CrimeCon to encourage people to submit their DNA results to GEDmatch. Karen Binder from the DNA Doe Project talked with us via email about the presentation that DDP gave at CrimeCon and what their goals were in their presentations. She noted that they, including Margaret Press, DDP's founder, and Kevin Lord, another DDP member, presented on stage and that, quote, "I mentioned that some of our cases are fast to solve, but our cases from minority populations are difficult, and the most important thing that people can do is DNA test so that we have more matches for our does. At our booth, people could come up to us and find out if they're a match to any of the 12 featured cases, one of which was Julie Doe. Some people did find out that they share a distant ancestor with Julie. Julie Doe's DNA matches are primarily from the southeastern United States, so I'm confident that the right match for her is out there, and that will help her team crack the case." End quote. The DNA Doe Project's TikTok, Facebook, and other social media show some of the results of the Doe Matching Project. Many of CrimeCon's attendees found out they're distantly related to one or more of the decedents the team are hoping to identify. While the majority of the matches were in the 10 to 8 centimorgan range, which is a match too small to use for genealogy, it's still a strong lead because perhaps others in your extended family or region may wish to upload a test. Since I was already in the GEDmatch system, Karen Binder ran my kit against the 12 Doe profiles they'd selected for the program, and I came back as a distant relative, for, of all the 12 decedents featured at the event, Julie Doe. My result was 8.9 centimorgans, so not enough for genealogy. But maybe you can be the one to help DNA Doe Project close their case. Uploading your own 23andMe or Ancestry results to GEDmatch is easy. We've included a link in our show notes to guides that will walk you through the process. And once you've gotten your GEDmatch kit number, you can visit DDP's social media and see which case they're featuring that month. If you're interested, you can enter your kit number on the DDP spreadsheet they provide and request to have your results compared directly to the featured case. They'll let you know if you're a match and how high. Julie was the featured case for June, but there will be a new case each month. And our audience is so strong in the Southeast that we hope you'll consider submitting your results to GEDmatch. You might just be the one to help the DNA Doe Project identify Julie Doe. We hope that we'll be able to update you again soon and tell you that Julie's case has been resolved. In the meantime, we hope you'll enjoy this fully remastered version of her original episode. Content advisement for the update of this episode was provided by Lee and Anthony Redgrave of the TransDoe Task Force. The original episode was remastered for you by Scott Stronach. Due to the discussion of violence, sexual assault, and details of autopsy, listener discretion is advised. There are some media quotes which misgender trans and trans-adjacent victims. This is The Fall Line.
It's very hard to get out of the checkbox mind frame of, you know, the old police work with the forms. You've got one or the other, check one. And that's the way all forms are in any kind of matching system. And it's all computerized now, so it should be easy to check across both categories or all categories. And the fact that that isn't done is going to make these people who fall into these shades of gray be overlooked. They're going to fall through the cracks.
She was found off Green Swamp Road, just a few miles east of Highway 33. The swamp stretches over 110,000 acres in five counties. Its outskirts are fringed with scrub oak and wooded state routes. If you go far enough, you hit I-75. You can ride that all the way to Georgia. She might have been traveling the roads that September. It was 1988, and hitchhiking was more common. She might have traveled with a friend or a partner or someone she thought she could trust. She'd been in that scrub off Greenswamp Road for a long time, probably since winter. She lay face up in a ditch, obscured by overgrowth of waist-high weeds. January and February had been mild, with highs in the 60s, but the heat set in by June. And she lay undiscovered through the summer, exposed to the elements, the sun and rain, the animals. By the time she was finally found, authorities would have no obvious means by which to identify her. They searched, even with metal detectors, but nothing but her body remained. The closest home was a mile away, and the residents there knew nothing of her. She was a strawberry blonde with brown roots. On the day she died, she'd been wearing a greenish-blue tank top, a denim skirt, and pantyhose. Her body lay just north of the Polk County line, where she was found by a man who'd been looking for cypress lumber. And she was badly decomposed, mostly skeletonized. Her pantyhose were partially rolled down. And her skirt was pulled down too, and though the cause of her death was not apparent, it was evident that her body had been hidden. She was not the first or the last. In 1984, the body of a woman who has come to be known as Allatoona Jane Doe was discovered in the Ocala National Forest. She was small and maybe 20. She wore a baggy shirt printed with flowers and the words, "Have you kissed your child tonight?" Websites Namus and the Doe Network both include the same crime scene photo, a single light brown shoe. Then came the woman we now know as Julie Doe, found in September of 1988. Over the next 3 years, more bodies were discovered in Lake County. One victim, Pamela Cole, was from New York. She was identified by police as a sex worker. She was 34 years old and found in a wooded area near Leeburg. She had been strangled. Her body was discovered by a 12-year-old girl. It was the girl's usual path home from the bus stop. That same year, 1991, another woman was found off 474, near where Julie Doe was discovered. She'd been tortured and posed. Law enforcement described the stage scene as indicative of a killer's signature, and they suspected that whoever he was, he'd killed before. Eventually, a man named Joseph Rowell was convicted of her rape but acquitted of her murder in one of the first trials in Florida to use DNA evidence. He was sentenced to life. Rowell told authorities that he didn't know the victim's name. He'd picked her up with the promise of drugs. Just that she was a small woman with reddish-brown hair and hazel eyes. The coroner suspected she'd had at least one child, and she remains unidentified to this day. Authorities suspected that Rowell had more victims, perhaps even some of the other women who'd been dumped in the Lake County area. Rowell was in the military when Julie Doe was killed and would have been stationed off the West Coast at that time. That doesn't necessarily preclude a trip home to Florida, but there's no proof he was in town when she died. The next case came in 1993, when a badly decomposed body was found by hog hunters. A vulture led them to a wooded crime scene, and the woman they found there was eventually identified as Claudia Roden, a hosiery mill worker from Alabama who'd simply stopped reporting to work, as had her husband, employed at the same plant. He was implicated in her death. The Orlando Sentinel reported that the key to her identification was an ornate Guns N' Roses tattoo. She was 21 years old. One woman in 1984, another in 1988, two in 1991, and one in 1993. Two identified killers, two identified victims. No clear pattern to the timing, no apparent connection between the cases. All of the victims were white, and all were found in or near the woods. All were in the Lake County area. Police looked at possible connections to a series of strangulation deaths in Jacksonville, Florida. That's just a little northeast of Lake County. The attacks there were eventually attributed to a few different men, including a now-convicted serial killer named Patrick Allen Harold. He pled guilty to the murders of three women, all white sex workers, all dumped off Florida highways. Police tracked him down because he'd left a single bloody fingerprint on a victim's body. Harold was suspected of the death of at least one other woman, Sharon Sangster, but was not prosecuted for her murder. She's still listed in Florida as a cold case. Like Julie Doe, she was a dyed blonde. Like Julie Doe, she was killed in 1988. Was he considered in the other Lake City cases, Pamela Cole, Julie Doe? Authorities haven't said. In the same time frame, serial rapist and migrant farm worker James Alfred Holloway was suspected in another series of strangulation murders. Black women from all over the state of Florida, but especially around the Jacksonville area. The women, including an 80-year-old grandmother named Maggie Risby, had their bodies posed after death. Maggie had been a friend of Holloway's grandmother. He was arrested after he attacked a 22-year-old woman who was walking home from a birthday party. The Orlando Sentinel reported that she bit her assailant's fingertip off during the struggle. And when Holloway was found, he had a matching injury. Police say that he initially confessed to a series of unsolved cases and they'd hoped to close a number of homicides, but he recanted, and he was eventually sentenced for rape and attempted murder. The case of Maggie Risby remained cold until 2004. That's when Holloway discarded a toothpick that police were able to retrieve. According to the Tampa Bay Times, they ran his DNA against swabs taken from Maggie Risby's fingernails. And they got a hit. Holloway was charged with her murder. But as for the other women they suspected him of killing, the news trail is harder to follow, and we don't know what happened. Many were sex workers. Some women's names appeared only once or twice in the papers, like Pamela Gambles, Laverne Mack, Nancy Jenkins. Pamela and Laverne are listed on the Columbia County cold case page, and Nancy isn't listed anywhere. Other serial killers operated in Florida in the late 80s and early 90s. Some sources estimate that number of active serial murderers in the state at more than a dozen. There was the Gainesville Ripper, Danny Rowling, who in 1990 killed 5 college students. From 1989 to 1990, Eileen Wuornos murdered men all over the state. In 1986, truck driver Oscar Ray Bolin killed at least 3 women. And he'd go on to marry a member of his defense team on live TV. And those are just a few who've been identified. We used the Cold Case Project database to examine unsolved homicides of Florida women between 1986 and 1995. According to the results, there are 11 unsolved strangulations, 25 stabbings, 23 shot, 4 dead by blunt force trauma. Many of the strangulation cases are in the northeastern part of the state, in counties like Duval, Lake, Madison, and Polk. There wasn't much archival news available, but we were able to determine that many were dumped on or near highways. This doesn't tie Julie Doe and the other women to one killer, or even a handful of killers. But it can tell us quite a bit in regards to how bodies are disposed of and what role interstates and roadways play in that process. Ginger Strand's 2012 book, Killer on the Road, Violence in the American Interstate, explores how, since the 1950s, interstate access has intersected with homicide. The ability to move more easily from one state to another makes criminals harder to track and victims more difficult to identify. This slow realization has led the FBI to develop the Highway Serial Killing Initiative. For those who aren't familiar, the FBI's history of the initiative explains that in 2004, law enforcement in Texas and Oklahoma noticed a pattern. More than 40 bodies dumped along the state's shared highways. Eventually, they began to identify a suspect pool, principally made up of long-haul truckers. According to the FBI's own 2017 podcast, quote, "The Highway Serial Killings Initiative has led to the identification of more than 400 suspects since it began more than a decade ago. More than 700 victims have been identified, with at least one in every state but Hawaii." They also explain that 10 suspects have been arrested as a result of the initiative, including 2 men responsible for at least some of those Oklahoma-Texas crimes. The victims of these crimes were and are mostly women. Many of them worked in the sex industry and especially in and around truck stops. Whether or not they are sex workers, they can be home insecure, dealing with the effects of poverty and addiction, and dependent on others for transportation. It's well known that predators will seek out victims who are less likely to get police or media attention. As Green River killer Gary Ridgway explained after his arrest, quote, "I picked up prostitutes because I thought I could kill as many of them as I wanted without getting caught." In 2018, sociologist Lee and Reed published a paper, Serial Killers and Their Easy Prey. In it, they looked at the intersection of sex work and safety. They reported that sex workers are, quote, 18 times more likely to be killed by a serial killer than someone who does not participate in sex work. And the authors cite numerous examples of sex workers either afraid to report violent assaults or ignored when they do. Even as in the case of a survivor of Canadian serial killer Robert Picton, when they arrive at the emergency room with stab wounds and a handcuff still around one wrist. Across the United States, local groups have tried to make sex work a little safer. Lee and Reed note the publication of bad guy client lists and the establishment of anonymous tip lines. The Global Network of Sex Work Projects offers a free PDF of information aimed at improving safety in working environments, too. But the illegality of sex work naturally limits that impact. It's easy to recognize one change that would come with decriminalization. Authorities would catch some of these killers much, much earlier. Perhaps there would not be another Gary Ridgway or Samuel Little killing scores of women across decades. Back to Florida. Of the Lake County and Jacksonville victims, roughly half were known sex workers. Of the known killers, three were serial murderers. And as for Julie Doe, her precise cause of death, as we said, is not known. She was not identified as a known sex worker, and there wasn't much media on her case to analyze. In 1988, only a few articles appeared, mostly in the Orlando Sentinel. And that was a little surprising, because she had many features that we might associate with a victim who'd generate news. She was blonde, she was white, she was probably not more than 30, and she had been in good health. She had breast implants, which signaled that at some point she'd had money to afford surgery. Her nails were manicured and her hair was dyed. She'd had a nose job. And yet, she did not attract interest. The Altoona Jane Doe, who died 2 years later, is much easier to track down in the news archives. But then again, her cause of death was known. Her killer was caught. She had been tortured and posed. Perhaps that very fact attracted more attention. In general, Doe cases fade quickly. There's no family to quote or to push for coverage to continue. We can say one thing with certainty. Julie's case was investigated. Several searches were performed, including a sweep involving a marine detail. Detectives tracked a number of leads, most centered on a group of young people who were employed at the Lake Orange Country Club in the area. Their stories were confusing and very convoluted. Some claimed that a man nicknamed Bubba said he'd been the one to find Julie's body, and that when he found it, he thought she was his friend Cheryl. When they tracked Bubba down, he denied this and said that he'd simply heard that the woman who was found looked like Cheryl, and so he'd then called Cheryl to make sure she was okay. Then there were stories of a series of women who might have gone missing or had recently been seen with Bubba. Anyone who vaguely matched Julie's description was up for discussion. And no matter the story, Bubba seemed to float to the center of each conversation. There were rumors that Julie might have been a woman seen at a local gas station by an attendant, one who turned down the offer of beer from a male customer. That customer was eventually identified as Bubba. There were some discussions of a former girlfriend from out of town who'd, quote, let Bubba down hard, but she'd been at work the day after Julie's body was found. Ultimately, no ties were found to connect Julie to Bubba or any of his friends. The only lead outside of that friend circle was a tip that regarded a local sex worker who operated around the truck stops. Authorities were able to locate her, though, and ascertain her well-being within a few days. Our FOIA request returned hundreds of pages. Incident reports, autopsy results, pictures of the scene, of Julie Doe's skull and of her teeth. Lake County collected a wide array of evidence, including soil samples and video of the crime scene, and they've kept those items in good order for the past 30 years. Their coroner found a number of premortem injuries, including a broken rib, a broken toe, and other healed trauma. Most notably, there was a report proving that Dr. William Maples examined Julie's body. In 1988, it would have been hard to find a forensic anthropologist with a better reputation. As the Orlando Sentinel explained, he participated in the examinations of everyone from President Zachary Taylor to the remains of Joseph Merrick, also known as the Elephant Man. According to Smithsonian Magazine, he also worked to identify the Romanovs and was involved in the cold case of civil rights leader Medgar Evers. His team's work led to a conviction in Evers' case of a white supremacist who'd shot Evers down in his own driveway. There was not a more public-facing forensic anthropologist at the time, especially one so respected in his own academic community. William Maples died in 1997, long before the 2015 DNA results that transformed the investigation of Julie Doe. That test showed that Julie had XY chromosomes and had undergone gender confirmation surgery in the years before her death. The woman whose family they tried so hard to find might not have known she was gone, or they might have been looking for her as someone assigned male at birth. Maybe it's hard to understand that Maples could have come to the conclusion that Julie was a cisgender female, and more so that she'd given birth to at least one child. There's certainly a lot of internet criticism on that topic, but it's important to consider that he based his conclusions on the best science available in 1988. When I spoke to Tamara Dale, the investigator currently assigned to Julie's case, she agreed, and she's been a tireless advocate for resolution. To explain how Maples concluded that Julie was cisgender, you need to know a bit about forensic anthropology and how it's continued to develop over the years. Maples was most active in the 70s, 80s, and 90s. And in the mid to late 90s, the doctor was diagnosed with brain cancer. He passed away in 1997. Around the time Maples became ill, there was a shift in anthropological practice. His former mentee, Robert Warren, has stated such. When Maples was most active in his field, forensic texts described skeletonized remains as commonly grouped into sex category by bone length, skull shape, and changes in the pelvic and hip regions. And many of those aspects are still considered today. Viewed in tandem, the picture can be fairly complete, but a single point of comparison may be less definitive. For instance, in isolation, a tall woman's femur and a short man's femur would not be precise predictors. That's why multiple comparisons are helpful. Before DNA testing is done, if it is done at all, there's commonly a study of the size of jaw, smoothness of skull, wideness of pelvis, width of the pelvis socket, and so on. According to an article by Molly Bierman on sapiens.org, pelvic bones may not always easily fall into the categories of male or female. Depending on a variety of factors, the bones may be graded on a scale of 1 to 5, with 3 being a pelvis of uncertain category. She uses this information to point out the lack of studies outside of sexual binaries, most especially among transgender and intersex individuals. So, not only may an individual be miscategorized, the categories themselves may not reflect human variance. Dr. Maples would have used a variety of markers in Julie's case, but not DNA. After all, it was 1988. Her initial autopsy was performed by Lake County Examiner Dr. Schultz just a day after she was found. To explain what remains Dr. Schultz had left to examine and how he interpreted them, it's clearest if we directly reference the autopsy. The following notations, though not the whole of the report, are particularly related to age, sex, and race. He notes, the orbits are oval, and this is a marker of race. Suture lines in the skull, which determine age, are closed but not fused. The pelvis is noted of being a female type. The majority of tissue of the neck is absent. There is damage to the hyoid bone, the bone right above the Adam's apple, which he describes as congenital. The report goes on to mention a rupturing of her silicone implants. It's unknown whether they were ruptured before death or due to decomposition. The implants were likely inserted around 1983. And there's also a note that she had an average-sized nose, which is followed by a list of the clothing found on her body. Two of the points he mentions, the pelvis and the tissue of the neck, may be the most important. In 1988, gender confirmation surgery was poorly understood and much more rare than it is today. Couple that lack of knowledge with the following information. Few of her organs remain, which could easily account for the lack of a uterus. Or a hysterectomy would be an equally reasonable explanation for that. The report does not specify what classifies her pelvis as female, though we know the female pelvis is generally wider, if smaller in size. The report ends by stating, quote, "These were the remains of a fairly tall, strong white female who died most likely in her mid to late 20s. He notes that she had probably given birth and showed no signs of premortem trauma or disease, aside from healed and, quote, fairly significant facial injuries. Cause of death was unknown, but she had not died at the scene. Her body had been dragged and placed. A homicide, a hit and run, an accidental overdose, there were a variety of possibilities. But someone hit her, like so many women before and after her. Animal predation, weather, and decomposition can affect positioning. So, if Julie had been posed, that was not apparent when she was found. But she was left with her pantyhose rolled down, which makes it feel like a hit and run or an overdose was unlikely. After the initial autopsy, she was examined by Dr. Maples in his own Florida lab. Most of his findings aligned with the county coroner's. He agreed on time of death. He notes near the beginning of his report that, quote, "These are clearly the remains of a white female." And he goes on to offer a precise review, detailing specific traits and how they fit into classification. For instance, Dr. Maples notes that Julie's very well-developed muscles are support for her having had at least one child. Various bone formations, fusions, and ossifications confirmed an age range of 24 to 32. The doctor actually disagrees regarding the fracture of the hyoid bone, the bone above the Adam's apple. But he agrees she had an extensive facial trauma concentrated around her nose. He doesn't specify nose job here, though that is noted in later internal reports. He does not comment on her pelvis either. Based on reports prepared after Julie's DNA was tested, a major component of the female pelvis designation would have been pitting. Before women give birth, hormone secretion affects the pelvis via the release of what a 2015 lab report describes as, quote, "hormones estrogen and recumbent relaxin, a peptide hormone that induces ripening of the cervix prior to childbirth." There's a specific groove, too, considered characteristic to the female pelvis, which a radiology study found in 32% of women and 0% of men. But estrogen pitting can create marks that look similar to this groove. It wasn't until the mid-1990s that anthropological papers began to note occasional pelvic pitting and grooving in male pelvises. This is thought to be caused by the prostate, which can also secrete relaxin. Hormonal therapy can introduce large doses of estrogen to the body, which can in turn cause pitting in everyone, no matter their chromosomes. Science might be called what we know, what we used to know, and what we will know. And its application is by necessity shaped by the people employing the best techniques of the day. In the 1980s, few Americans could afford gender confirmation surgery, which in turn means that few doctors had experience with post-transition patients. Dr. Maples' mentee, Robert Warren, now heads up his old identification lab at the University of Florida. If you'll recall, he's the one who discovered that Julie had been through transition. According to the Sentinel, it began as part of an initiative to review cold cases with improved technology. When asked why his mentor had classified Julie as cisgender, he pointed to the changing view of bone pitting. But he also touched on a key point, quote, "All the reports called the person a female. If you're getting all that information, it can influence you." Julie's remains were kept in the laboratory for 27 years, where they were stored after Dr. Maples issued his report. In the same Orlando Sentinel article, Warren describes pulling Julie's remains from storage. He remembers being startled to see several markers that indicated that she may have been born, quote, biologically male, including narrow aspects of the pelvis and the length of her leg bones. Those discrepancies pushed his team to extract and run DNA in 2015. That test revealed that Julie had XY chromosomes, and the scientist reclassified her as, quote, biologically male. And so, police had been chasing down leads and taking tips without knowing that, at some point in Julie's history, she was likely known to family and friends and neighbors as male or male-presenting. Julie was found without a purse or wallet or any form of identification. She may have been transient, but she was in general good health and was able to maintain a manicure, which is no easy feat on the road. Unlike many trans women of the 1980s, it seems Julie had regular access to hormone treatment. We spoke to Ivana Black, who was quoted in last week's episode about hormone availability in the 1990s. She estimated that only 10% of the people she knew were able to consistently access prescribed hormones, and that it was even more difficult for those who move between cities. At least one member of law enforcement theorizes that Julie could have been a sex worker. Location of the dump site and the high cost of surgery could support that theory, though she certainly could have funded her own confirmation procedures in a number of ways. In the 1980s, that surgery would have likely taken place in a larger city, maybe Atlanta or New Orleans or even overseas. When we spoke to DeKalb Medical Examiner's office in Georgia and about another case, we learned that serial numbers on medical implants are a recent development. Before that, it could be possible to trace a medical device to a hospital, but that's never a sure bet. Apparently, hospitals would often exchange medical devices based on need. For instance, Tennessee needs a certain something, so South Carolina sends it over. Then North Carolina asks for an item, and Alabama obliges. That sort of trade-off went on for a long time. So in Julie's case, the breast implants were not going to be the magic link to her identity. The involvement of the DNA Doe Project and the Trans Doe Task Force have been key to what's been accomplished since the discovery. If you're familiar with forensic genealogy, then you've likely heard of Dr. Colleen Fitzpatrick and Margaret Press. They are two highly trained genealogists who realize the potential of DNA to aid in identification. Like many other genealogists, they'd worked mostly on family histories, like helping adoptees find their birth families. The new tool of familial DNA has widened the possibilities of what they can do and what they can find. The public probably truly became aware of this kind of work when another forensic genealogist, Barbara Ray Venter, was instrumental in the identification of the Golden State Killer in 2018. And since then, forensic DNA has helped to close many more cases. You may be aware that there are public DNA sharing sites like GEDmatch, where users of private DNA sites like Ancestry or 23andMe can upload their raw data. Users can then connect with relatives who use different private sites, and researchers are able to connect the forensic dots. Colleen and Margaret's DNA Doe Project has used GEDmatch to successfully identify several well-known does, including Lyle Stevick, Anaheim Jane Doe, and Buckskin Doe. And we have no doubt that by the time this episode airs, more cases will have been closed. We had the honor of speaking with Colleen about her work, and we asked her to describe her introduction to forensic genealogy, and then tell us a bit about the process.
My name is Colleen Fitzpatrick. I am the co-executive director of the DNA Doe Project, the founder of Identifinders International, and the author of Forensic Genealogy. In about 2017, Margaret Press made contact with me with a question about why we couldn't use genetic genealogy to identify John and Jane Does. It had been a big question in the genealogy community. And because the databases, the direct-to-consumer DNA databases, had gotten so large, you know, there was a lot of pressure to try to see if we could use them for forensic purposes. But those companies don't work forensic cases. So as Margaret and I talked a little bit, we found that, in fact, we could come up with some workarounds and that maybe we could apply the same technology, although not with the direct-to-consumer companies, but we could apply the same technology to identifying John and Jane Doe's. In the first few cases we did, we reached out to law enforcement. I've worked 100 cold cases in one way or another, so I had a lot of contacts. And at that time, in 2017, nobody knew what this meant. Nobody in law enforcement understood autosomal SNP testing or GEDmatch. So we had to reach out because, you know, nobody would reach to us. They didn't know what was going on. And after we got a couple of success stories behind us, then we started to, you know, hear from law enforcement more and more. And now we really don't do many reach outs. We do once in a while we reach somebody. But a lot of agencies still don't know what this is, or believe it or not, some have not even heard of it. So that, you know, if we reach out to the agencies, it can be an uphill battle that we don't have time for. So basically right now, we hear from agencies every day.
With the growing number of cases brought to them by law enforcement or suggested by other organizations and civilian groups, we wondered if the DNA Doe Project has had to turn down cases.
We really have not turned down any cases. Whether we go forward or not usually depends on the quality and the quantity of DNA. That being said, we're actually doing a lot of research on how to improve our approach to very degraded DNA and also very low-level DNA. That's what distinguishes us from the rest of the people doing this, that, to my knowledge, is that we're trying to do more and more with less and less in parallel to the forensic research community. We're in touch with many of those people, and so it's not how many cases we take in, it's how many success stories we have and how quickly we can come to those success stories.
When people, and we include ourselves in that, have an interest in true crime, it can result in a wide but shallow understanding of how the science works. We know DNA is taken, for instance, but then what? What's done with it? The preparation of DNA for, say, CODIS is not what a forensic genealogist would use. So we asked Colleen how, after choosing a case like Julie Doe, which they're working on as of this recording, they would proceed.
The first step to researching a Doe case really is to check the DNA, to get the two labs, the law enforcement agency and our lab, to talk to each other to find, again, the quality and quantity of DNA. If we find, you know, it's within our range, then we send it to the lab and we do a process or two. We get a GEDmatch kit done. In the meanwhile, we read the case files. We look at the case history. We understand how the DNA has been stored. We try to research everything we can. We talk to the agency. We get in touch. You know, we get familiar with the detective who's working on the case. We get, you know, the whole backstory so that when we're getting ready to upload to GEDmatch, you know, we do that with some background, some knowledge about what we hope to see or what we think we might see. And then we upload it to GEDmatch. We take a look at the matches. We make sure that, you know, that we know what we're dealing with and we can advise the agency whether it's going to be hard, easy, medium. And then we just tell them to have patience and we start building trees and, you know, trying to use some of the GEDmatch tools to, you know, understand the different sides of the family and basically do the genealogy.
Julie's case has run into trouble at that first step. That is, getting a viable DNA sample translatable into a usable format for genealogy. So far, the DNA Doe Project and Lake County have attempted 3 extractions in hope of getting enough DNA to produce a successful GEDmatch profile. The most recent attempt used an experimental process requiring much less material. Since Julie's case was revived in 2015, DNA has not been the only avenue pursued. In that time, Lake County officers have sent out hair, teeth, and bone samples for isotope testing. Isotopes can aid archaeologists and forensic scientists in a number of ways. They can tell how long ago a person lived and in what region or regions they lived in. Some regional groups are broad and might include an area like Northeast Florida and South Georgia. And others may have markers for several places that are not necessarily next to each other on a map, but bear strong similarities in the markers they create. The test performed on Julie Doe indicated that she came from South Florida, and Though she was found in Florida, that's still helpful information. After all, as someone who was left along the highway, the possibilities were endless. Another advancement in Julie's case is an updated forensic portrait out in early 2019. We've seen it, and the picture is beautiful. Julie looks a bit like Daryl Hannah and stands in the foreground of a calm beach scene. The digital illustration is all soft blues and grays, a striking contrast to the forensic sketch from a few years ago, which was done in black pencil. In that one, there's an air of unhappiness that makes it feel a bit like a mugshot. Though DNA sex designation can aid in cold case identification, the information may not always help investigators create an accurate picture of an unidentified person. In some cases, when the only available categorizations of remains are biologically male or biologically female, we might miss a variety of factors that affect how a decedent identified, presented, or was known. For those interested in resolving Doe cases, knowing that a person's listed sex and their gender identity and expression may not line up is important. And that's precisely where the Trans Doe Task Force comes in. Co-founder Lee Bingham Redgrave told us they began their work to honor their friend, Krista Lee Steele Nudslein, who was murdered in 2018. They focus on combing through Doe cases for signs that a decedent may have been trans or otherwise gender expansive. Because of the high rates of violence perpetrated against the trans community, they estimate the number of trans and gender variant Does to be in the hundreds. After they find possible cases, they gather information into templates to submit to the DNA Doe Project. There's the basic information, like police contacts and dates and times, but they look especially at mention of clothing, accessories, and other forms of expression. And then they submit their findings to the DNA Doe Project in hopes that DNA analysis can be performed. Julie Doe's case is a major focus, but they're working on many smaller, less well-known Doe cases too. Trans Doe Task Force does not assume the gender identity of Does. They simply gather the facts of the case in hopes that their work will make some dent in the number of unidentified trans Does and the number of unsolved murders. The details of each case could add up to the decedent having identified in any number of ways. In cases such as NamUs UP10528, also known as the Pillar Point Doe, Trans Doe Task Force specifically assigns a neutral pronoun in their social media discussions. NamUs lists the decedent as approximately 5'10", about 140 pounds, and brown-haired with hazel eyes. The victim showed obvious signs of overkill. They had been beaten, strangled, and stabbed only hours before discovery. They were also wearing feminine clothing, including capri pants, beige panties, and a padded beige bra. As we reported in episode 2, overkill is a classic sign of bias crime. There was no evidence of where this victim originated, but police had ideas. In 2011, the Mercury News covered a number of San Mateo Doe cases and included this passage on the Pillar Point victim. Quote, "Police think the transvestite may have been picked up in San Francisco's tough Tenderloin neighborhood by men who thought he was a woman. When they discovered he was a transvestite, they beat him to death," police theorize. "The young man is buried in an unmarked grave in Colma," end quote. Though mentioned in media reports, possible connection to the Tenderloin has not been confirmed by official police sources. And as Anthony Redgrave of the Trans Doe Task Force pointed out, there's no evidence that the Pillar Point Doe was engaged in sex work. Recently, new digital manipulation of the original Pillar Doe forensic sketches were released, and the results are singular. Four different variations on how they may have looked based on possible gender expression. This approach doesn't render the sketches too broad or make them too generally applicable. The same features shine through. It's just the gender expression that changes. And those changes can trigger memory of a witness, a friend, a family member, because as we learn from DeKalb County Medical Examiner, it's micro details that we, the viewers, focus on. Make a victim's hair blonde, and many will have trouble imagining it brown. What if this variation were more common in forensic sketching? Would there be more positive identifications? Groups like the TransDoe Task Force think so, and they hope to marry science, genealogy, and contemporary, complex understandings of sex and gender and expression to close more cold cases and create better resources. As Lee Bingham Redgrave told us,
I think that the most important thing to do when you are looking at a DOE is to throw out your assumptions about what that person might have been like in their life or who they might have been. Because doing forensic genealogy work and working with the DNA DOE project and working on the cases that I've worked on, you're always going to be surprised. And it's not going to be what you expect. And that's true for any genealogist. You can't predict where your research is going to take you. People do all kinds of stuff. People go all kinds of places in their lifetimes and have all kinds of experiences. And it's really fascinating and completely unpredictable.
If Robert Warren had not decided to review cold cases in 2015 and noted a few indications that Julie had been misclassified, it's unlikely that anyone would have ever heard of her. It takes widespread, consistent media coverage to make the mainstream aware, the kind that forensic genealogy is getting right now, with case after case reaching a successful close. And not just DOE cases either. Decades-old sexual assaults, unsolved murders, serial killings, all are meeting their match at the combination of genealogical research and public source DNA. It seems simple, and we wonder why more people don't do it, but Colleen Fitzpatrick of the DNA DOE Project cautioned us that the apparent speed and ease isn't as it seems.
What I really want people to understand is this is hard work. You see a lot of cases in the news, especially killers, that pop, pop, pop. You know, every day there's a new one. And it sounds really easy, but it's not. It's hard work. And I'm going to guess, I'm just from our statistics I see in the DNA DOE project, that probably one in 20 cases really is an easy case. That, you know, you look at it, it takes you a few hours, you know, it takes you, you know, maybe a week. The rest of the cases, you know, on the average take a few months. And we have a couple of cases we're still working on after 16 months. So I want people to know that you just can't do it and pop. You know, it's actually very difficult. And I'd like to tell the genealogists out there the same thing, that if you want to do this, understand there's a lot to it, that you don't just go to your local sheriff's department or your local police department and say, hey, I want to help you with genealogy. Give me a GEDmatch kit. It's not like that. You have to be knowledgeable about the DNA, about, you know, quality, quantity, what it means. My takeaway is this is hard work. It's not like in the news, all the excitement in the news, that's great. But that's only the tip of the iceberg. The rest of it is very difficult.
Colleen hopes to attract the help of genealogists with an interest in populations underrepresented in public DNA databases. She also highlighted the need for more grassroots groups like the TransDoe Task Force who choose to focus on a region or a population. Any kind of focus makes that daunting task of sorting through thousands of cases and gathering information more doable. The TransDoe Task Force welcomes the aid of those who can write blog articles, do archival newspaper research, or go through missing persons listings, but you don't have to have a particular skill set to make a difference. According to Lee Bingham Redgrave, simple willingness to increase awareness can do a lot. 2018 was a landmark year for cold cases. And as of the writing and recording of this episode, in the spring of 2019, investigators are well on their way to raising that bar. There are big name cases that may be solved this year, that may be solved by the time this episode airs, like the Zodiac, perhaps the Oakland County child killer, or the deaths of Amy Mihaljevic, or Libby German and Abby Williams, of Faith Hedgepeth, of the hundreds of others whose cases have been aided by developments in DNA technology. Perhaps we'll even have the honor of updating Julie Doe's episode and marking it as resolved. We can hope. If you have information as to the identity of the woman known as Julie Doe, please contact investigator Tamara Dale of the Lake County Sheriff's Office at 352-343-2255. 2101. Special thanks to Anthony Redgrave for content advisement, the TransDoe Task Force, and the DNA Doe Project. You can find links to their websites in the show notes. Additional content advisement by Winner Wheeler and Brandy Williams, with research assistance from Kim Fritz and Haley Gray. Next time, we discuss two Georgia cases, unidentified children from DeKalb and Ware counties. And we talk to the staff of a medical examiner's office who are passionate about identifying the child they call Dennis Doe. We hope you'll join us then.